From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
Joshua Prager's book, The Echoing Green, has arrived just in time for the baseball playoffs. It's about the home run that Bobby Thompson of the New York Giants hit off Brooklyn Dodgers pitcher Ralph Branca in the playoff game of the 1951 season. That one moment, the so-called shot heard round the world, transcended the world of sports and became one of those legendary incidents that define people's lives. Mr. Prager has examined the event and exposed one of baseball's darkest secrets in the process. His book is published by Pantheon, and it brings him to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And The Echoing Green comes from William Blake. You even include some William Blake paintings. So what's going on here? I mean, this is about Bobby Thompson hitting a home run, isn't it?
Well, the poem, The Echoing Green, yes, there's an etching that we've included as a frontispiece in the book, and it's beautiful. And you can see, if you look, a person holding a bat and a ball. The poem is from his collection, Songs of Innocence. And the poem is all about contrasting innocence and experience and joy and sorrow and set atop a ball field. So it seemed very appropriate.
Your prologue begins with a list of dates compiled over the years as a gauge of American memory. And this incident is one of the prominent ones.
It's amazing. Literally millions of people remember where they were when this happened, right up there with JFK being shot and 9/11. And there are all sorts of reasons for that.
Even though it happened in 1951, you weren't even born in 1951.
That's right. I'd heard about it. I am the son of a diehard Brooklyn Dodger fan. And I'd heard about this always as a very sad, sad moment. And when I began to look into it, I saw that for literally millions of people, this was a moment that defined their childhood.
It also inspired a fair number of writers, John Steinbeck, Jack Kerouac, Philip Roth, most recently Don DeLillo and Underworld, all written about it. Why do you think this happened? I can't imagine a similar situation happening today. There are some pretty dramatic moments in recent baseball history. Why this? Was baseball different at that time?
Well, it was. Baseball was the be-all and end-all of American sport, and New York was the hub of baseball. There were three teams. They pretty much, at least one of them, went to the World Series every year. And there are a lot of reasons why this moment resonated so powerfully. One of them is that it was the first ever nationally televised sporting event, this playoff. And so people around the whole country gathered in front of storefronts, in the living room with the one person on the street who had a TV, and watched. The other thing is, this was the cap of an incredible comeback. And from a baseball point of view, the game was scripted like a little kid would imagine on a schoolyard.
Well, it was either a comeback if you were a Giants fan or a major swoon if you were a Dodgers fan. The Dodgers had been so far ahead.
That's
early
right.
In the season.
13 and a half games ahead as of August 11th. And this was the first home run ever to end a playoff or a World Series, and the first time ever that a team squandered a three-run lead in the ninth inning of a playoff or World Series.
In fact, the Dodgers had good reason to believe that they had the game in hand. But you're citing statistics. Is that another factor that this is the first time this happened, the first time that happened?
Well, I think it's...
Baseball fans love statistics.
Definitely. I mean, it's sort of like an autopsy of this moment. You want to figure out why is it that everyone remembers where they were. And I think also a very important part of this is that the Giant-Dodger rivalry was so rabid. It would kind of be like the Yankee-Red Sox rivalry if it was in the same city.
And in those days, with these three teams, it would have been different perhaps if this game had been between the Boston Braves and the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Definitely. In fact, the previous year, the 1950 season ended on an almost similar moment. You had Dick Sisler hitting a home run off Don Newcomb to win the pennant on the to deny the Dodgers the pennant on the last day of the season. But no one remembers that, and certainly no one pairs Sisler and Newcomb the way they do Thompson and Branca.
One of the key figures in all of this is Leo DeRocha, the Giants manager, who had been involved with all three New York teams.
That's right, and so had Charlie Dressen, the manager of the Dodgers. You know, one of the things that that is really that mattered so much at the time was who you rooted for. And you know, every boardroom, every classroom was divided along those lines. If your daughter was marrying someone, you'd want to know if they were a Yankee fan, a Dodger fan, a Giant fan. And I think when the two teams left in 1957, suddenly baseball didn't matter in the same way that it does now. I'm a diehard fan, but it mattered.
But it's also interesting that the Dodgers are the team that everybody remembers now. At the time, the Giants had as many fans. They had some of the greatest ball players that ever played in the city. Willie Mays was an extraordinary player, and I guess the only, maybe even greater than Jack, well, one of the greatest players that ever lived. So why do you think that the boys of summer are the Dodgers now? Is it because they lost so many of these games?
That's part of it, and I think that's one of the reasons why Branca, in a sense, is the sort of more romanticized figure of the two. But I think also race was a big part of that. The Dodgers, of course, integrated baseball. And Brooklyn was more closely bound up in the identity of its team than Harlem was with the Giants.
My guest is Joshua Prager, who is a senior special writer at the Wall Street Journal. And he's written a book called The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and The Shot Heard Round the World, published by Pantheon. Now, you broke the story of the stealing of signals. It had been long rumored, and I think Ralph Branca had often suggested that that's what had happened. When I spoke to him on the show a few years ago, he seemed extremely bitter.
This was a moment that he heard about almost every day of his life. He's now 80 years old, and of course, if anyone was told daily of their worst moment, they would become bitter too. I think when I wrote my article back in 2001 and showed that the Giants did in fact steal signs and proved it, found the telescope and the electrician who set up this buzzer system and the very window they started and the day they started, et cetera, Branca called me that day and he told me, "You loosened my lips." I think he was able after that, once it was known, to be more honest with himself and he was less hard-edged.
Well, don't teams always try to steal signs?
Definitely, but they don't do it this way. If a player is on second base, he's peering in for the signal. That's not only allowed, it's encouraged. This is
and catchers make adjustments.
Exactly. This was not unprecedented. I bend over backwards in the book to contextualize their cheating. I show that it went back to the 1800s. And had this not been the backdrop of baseball's most famous moment, no one really would have cared, but it was.
Well, how important is it for a batter to know what pitch is coming in? After all, you still got to hit the pitch. And you tell a story about Gary Carter telling batters what pitch is coming next.
That's right, with Tony Gwynn, and he did not want to know what was coming.
Gwynn was one of the greatest hitters of our time.
That's right. A lot of batters feel it's easier to simply react to a pitch and not know. But the day that this happened, they held this meeting on July 19th, and DeRocha went around the room and asked the team who wanted the signs, and a majority of the team did. Most say that it helps to know at least if it's going to be a fast pitch or an off-speed pitch. And Bobby Thompson was very honest with me that he benefited from the stolen signs, that he was in the wanting-to-know camp.
Uh-huh. Well, the Giants had been doing this for a while, hadn't they?
So
this was not the first game.
Right. They started on July 20th when they were 7.5 games back. They then went on a long road trip, were swept by the Dodgers and did not play well, came back, and like I said, they were then 13.5 back. They then won 16 games in a row. 13 of those games were at home.
It would have sent off alarm signals in some people's minds that there was such a discrepancy between their one loss record on the road and what they were doing in the Polo Grounds. Teams tend to do better at home, but not that much better.
Well, they did really take off, and at least one person, Cookie Lavaggetto, a coach on the Dodgers, was suspicious and brought binoculars to the park to sort of suss out what was going on in center field. But an umpire spotted the binoculars, took them away, and it went uncovered.
My guess is
uncovered. Excuse me.
Joshua Prager has written The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and The Shot Heard Round the World. It's published by Pantheon. So what happened? This is a complicated scheme. It involves an electrician. It involves, as you said earlier, a telescope, which wasn't spotted.
Right. Basically, in terms of the scheme, it was pretty simple. They set a man in center field, Herman Franks. He looked through the fourth window of the clubhouse. They cut out some of the wire mesh to make the spying a little easier, the wire mesh that covered the window. He then pressed a button that buzzed in the right field bullpen. The Giants were the only team whose park had bullpens in fair play. And then there on that bullpen, the man relayed the sign to the batter. There are several there. Between the two fastballs, Branca threw Thompson, for example, on October 3rd, 1951, 23 seconds elapsed. So there's time. And this whole sign-stealing, relaying scheme only took a few seconds. So they got quite good at it.
I've seen a film of that moment, and it's obvious Branca threw a very good pitch. It was not one of those over-the-plate easy to hit pitches, but it was a high
and somewhat inside fastball that Thompson turned on. He had taken a pitch right down the middle of the previous pitch.
So he knew the sign on the previous one, and he hit the harder to hit pitch, and that's the one that went out of the ballpark.
Well, when I asked him, I said, so did you get the signs for this very pitch, this at bat? He hemmed and hawed and said, I don't like to think of something taking away from it. I'd have to say more no than yes. What he has said was that he was distracted. Just before the at-bat against Branca, Don Mueller was injured running to third base after Whitey Lockman hit a double. Thompson went down to third base to see how his friend was doing, and he said that distracted him. What I cared more about in writing this book was not so much the effect that the sign-stealing had on play, but rather the effect that this secret had on the lives of both Thompson and Branca.
And I want to get to that in a moment, but I still want to understand. So we have this guy out there with a telescope. And then how is that transmitted to the batter?
He pressed a button that had been set up by an electrician named Abe Chadwick. And that button set off a buzzer in the right field bullpen. And there in the bullpen, a man, usually the backup catcher Sal Evars, heard this buzz once. It usually buzzed once for a fastball, twice for an off-speed pitch. And then he sent some sort of a hand signal to the batter.
And at first, the buzz was so loud, they were afraid that it would be discovered.
That's right. Al Corwin, who was a pitcher there, a rookie in 1951, told me that the first day it went off, it was so loud they literally fell off the bench. And the fans were just about 10, 12 feet above them. And the pitchers were sure that they'd be discovered, but they weren't.
So, okay, let's talk about how this affected these two players forever. Ralph Branca was a wonderful pitcher for the Dodgers, starting pitcher, sometimes brought in for relief. Bobby Thompson was a fine player for the Giants, not the star. Did they have other things in common?
Well, they both were from New York. They both were from large families. Branca's was even larger. They both had very, very fine seasons, but you're right. They were not the biggest star on the team. In fact, a few years earlier, they had barnstormed together. They had played ball in Middle America and had gone for a long drive together, just the two of them. They knew each other from a few All-Star games. But for Branca, what happened was after the home run, it was a true trauma for him. And then in 1954, 3 years later, a pitcher on the Tigers. Branca had been let go by the Dodgers, picked up by the Tigers, and a pitcher named Ted Gray told him that the Giants had been stealing signs. And this was a whole new trauma for him. And then when the rumors first became public in 1962 and no one cared, it was yet another trauma. So he was sort of being raked over the coals time and time again. And Thompson, meantime, who was a very good man and had been raised in a very strict Scottish home to do what's right, he felt very bad about this, and even had he not been the hero, it would have preyed on him more than all the other players.
Well, he'd almost been the goat of the game, hadn't he?
That's exactly right. He'd made a few poor fielding plays and a horrible base-running gaffe. So, yes, in fact, the announcers had been talking about that prior in the game.
And the Dodgers pitcher was Don Newcomb, who was a workhorse. Had he finally tired? Is that why Branca came in?
Well, Dressen, the manager, pitched Newcomb 34 innings over these 8 days. No pitcher in all of baseball has ever pitched that much since.
I remember he sometimes started both ends of a doubleheader.
That's right. And Dressen, he really mismanaged his staff. In fact, Clem Labine, who pitched the shutout the day before, had gone completely unused for weeks. So Dressen really did a bad job. And yes, Newcomb was exhausted, and they called in Branca.
It's amazing because today a pitcher goes past 110 pitches. They take him out even if he's pitching anything short of a shutout.
Yes.
I mean, a no-hitter. In fact, they take out pitchers who are pitching shutouts.
Yeah, it was a very, very different time. And the only team that was sort of already on to the use of statistics was the Dodgers. They had a man named Alan Roth who was a statistician and charted pitches. But Dressen wanted nothing to do with him, and he banished him to the broadcast pen.
What would Roth have told him?
He would have told him, A, that he should not have called in Branca. Branca actually had better numbers against Thompson than did Erskine, the other pitcher warming up. But the man who he should have called was Preacher Rowe. Preacher Rowe had a wonderful record against Thompson. And B, he would have told him that along the stretch, down the stretch, he should have been using other pitchers, like I said, Clem Labine.
Dressen wound up blaming the bullpen coach.
That's right, Cookie Lavaggetto. It's hard to find redeeming qualities in Dressen. I tried, trust me. But yes, that there had to be a scapegoat. Brooklyn was absolutely devastated, and it was Clyde Sukaforth, the bullpen coach, who was let go.
Now, Branca had another problem. He was the only pitcher in baseball to wear the number 13, and some people saw him as actually, pushing his own luck.
Well, it's interesting. What I found most interesting about that is that Branca has an exceptional memory. He went on the game show Concentration and won 17 games in a row, and this wasn't some dumbed-down celebrity version. He just has an amazing memory. And yet he misremembers an important fact, that the next season he wore the number 12, and he says that it was the Dodgers who made him switch numbers, but it wasn't. I found an article way back then where he talked about he and his family decided this. And so, yes, he did push his luck. People saw this as a horrible omen, coming in. And the famous article by Red Smith, who writes, "Now it is done, the art of fiction is dead," he finishes his article talking about the fact that Branca wore the number 13.
He even gave up his 13 vanity plates. And it was right. Unlucky for other people. The loss resulted in a mafia hit.
That's exactly right. Willie Moretti was the in charge of gambling in this area. And he was killed the next morning in Fort Lee. And it was pretty incredible for me to read that. And I spoke to members of the mafia. Bill Bonanno confirmed for me that this went on. And
well, why did they kill him? Because he lost so much money on the game?
I wasn't able ever to find something that talked about the fact that he'd, let's say, welched on bets. But it's too great a coincidence to think that the man who was in charge of gambling in this area and who presided over the most heavily gambled on game of the year was killed, 10 hours later for reasons not having to do with the home run.
Eventually, the Dodgers did win a World Series.
They did. 1955. Poor Branca was not on the team, but they did indeed.
Joshua Prager's book is The Echoing Green, The Untold Story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the Shot Heard Round the World. And Mr. Prager will be giving a talk and signing books that's tomorrow,
yeah,
at 7 o'clock, along with Ralph Branca and Bobby Thompson. That's at the Barnes & Noble store at Lincoln Center. His book is published by Pantheon, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.